Good morning, Jan. It's really great to be back with you. It's been a very long time since we've done a movie mole.
Yeah, movie moles in the ground coming up above to talk about
exactly.
This interesting movie.
I'm really happy to be back. We're talking about the film Tár, released in 2022. And Tár is a psychological drama directed by Todd Field, and it stars Cate Blanchett. The film charts the downfall of fictional composer and conductor Lydia Tár. And this morning, Jan, we're here to take up the mixed reviews and reactions to the film, and particularly in its portrayal of sexual and class politics. We will offer our readings of Tár as a morality play, plotting the fall of a highly ambitious and exploitative woman at the peak of her career.
Some critics view the film as problematic in its portrayal of women and the dynamics of abuse and power. One reviewer commented that Tár is a regressive film that takes bitter aim at so-called cancel culture and lampoons so-called identity politics, unquote. It's also interesting to look at the film, as we feminist critics often do, through the Bechdel test, the test that asks whether a film, number one, features at least two women, two, do they talk to each other, and three, do they talk about something other than a man? And from this feminist critical perspective, it is about women's relationships, and I think the Bechdel test also asks us to look at the complexity and range of female characters rather than counting positive characters on the screen. So I think it is an interesting film about power dynamics and the sexual elements of hierarchical relationships, including between students and teachers and mentors and mentees.
And these are not easy conversations to have. There's a lot to mine on this film, and there's a wide audience out there that is really welcoming the challenge that this film has taken up to tackle these questions and do it in a way that, as Martin Scorsese said, was a high wire act, and then to do it in such a way that, in my opinion, was interesting and compelling and good filmmaking. Of course, you can't miss with the performers who are in it, and Cate Blanchett and Nina Hoss, they've got long history of taking on complicated female characters. And so for that reason, I think people are drawn to the film and wanting to take up its complexities and contradictions.
Yeah, I mean, you could place it in the tradition of femme fatales and the noir genre, where you have a powerful woman rising. You know, she's transgressing boundaries, and she has a kind of charismatic power, but malevolent in her motives. And at the end of many noir films, you see the female protagonist punished at the end as she meets her fall. And the film does punish this very aggressive, exploitive woman at the film's denouement. But I think in between, there are some very interesting questions about how we're to view her. She's not a virtuous person. She's very narcissistic and exploitive in her relationships with people. The film is almost entirely from her point of view. We kind of look at the world through her eyes, and scenes, almost every frame is from her point of view. Sometimes we see her image duplicated through various reflections, so we have a sense of different dimensions of her, but throughout she's very exploitive and also sexually exploitive of her students and people over whom she has power. So I think that dynamic is always a complicated one to take up for feminists. I mean, you could say, how does this compare to how men are portrayed, who are also ambitious? Are women more apt to be punished in films for an excess of narcissism or ambition? Does it matter that she's a woman, or is it really about power where her gender is not so relevant?
Early in the release of the film, there was a lot of confusion about who Lydia Tár was, and many, including myself, confess to Googling this person to figure out, is this a real person? Because the film has a particular nature to it that really seems like a biopic.
Yeah, I mean, it opens with her being interviewed on a stage by Adam Kopnik with The New Yorker, and he's playing himself, and it feels like a real interview with a composer.
And if you get into reading about the film before you see it, you're maybe expecting it to be about Me Too or to be a message film or to be a cancel culture film. And it's been called all of those things. But the filmmaker and the leading actors really hold to this idea that this is an exploration of power and the misuse of power and what happens when someone is so powerful inside a very particular world. There's a lot of conversations in the film that refer to other composers of the past who had their own falls at the peak of their careers when their misdeeds had come to light. So they're laying out a kind of landscape within this world in which power is wielded in very particular ways. It's a world in which wealth and power and prestige and status, those are the rules of the game.
There's been some discussion online and among reviewers about the one clear victim of Lydia Tarr, the lead's mentorship and sexual predations, this young woman who we only know as Krista Taylor, who is an aspiring, apparently talented young student composer, who we never see. She's on the margins. We learn about her through conversations Liddy has with her assistant and concerns that arise. And as a spoiler alert, we learn she's committed suicide and that this prompts investigation on the part of her parents over a relationship with Lydia. And we learn that Lydia had mailed negative recommendations to institutes where Krista had applied. And basically, it ended this woman's career. Mm-hmm. And that this seems to be related to Krista pursuing her in a way where Lydia was done with her in a very cruel way. And we only learn about the relationship and try to piece it together through Lydia's conversation with her assistant. And we only know about her through Lydia's perspective as her abuser.
In terms of how we see the abuses take place in film and TV shows, there's lots of examples of programming that has tried to take up these questions around abuse of power within a workplace or in a situation in which someone can determine the course of your career. But there's some interesting writing about this film as having elements that are happening not necessarily in real time. I wouldn't say not in the real world, but Krista is in Tarr's orbit in all of the ways that you mention. But she's also sort of a haunting figure, and film actually begins with a conversation via a texting chain between what we might guess is Francesca, Lydia Tarr's current assistant, and Krista. It seems the three of them have had a relationship. They talk about how she's haunted, and the response is, do you mean she has a conscience? And the response is, maybe. So from the very beginning of the film, we're asked to question whether or not Lydia Tarr has a conscience and is she haunted. We do see Krista at the New Yorker event. We see her in front of a hotel. And I think she's brought in also more concretely through technology, as you mentioned, but also not just the technology of the emails, but through her correspondence with Francesca, who still has an ongoing relationship with Tarr. She's still Tarr's assistant. She still
and
has
she's
aspirations.
Also an aspiring conductor. And
exactly,
so
yeah.
Lydia Tarr has this capacity to anoint or destroy people or mm-hmm. to treat them as underlings in her world. Yeah, I think that question of is she plagued by guilt or something else interested me. As a psychologist who's interested in psychological portrayals, and this has been described as a psychological drama, I read her hauntings as more of a paranoia she developed. She's someone very obsessive and invested in controlling everything within her reach, and a world that she inhabits that's subject to her control, and she sees others as kind of instrumental in some way, extensions of her own desires, and not as having separate needs of their own. And I think there was an attempt to portray a narcissistic, controlling person who begins to realize that many of the people they control have wills and desires and capacities to punish them in their own right. So she begins to see things on the periphery, and there is a kind of anxious paranoia of scrutinizing.
Things go missing, noises, she hears the scream. Some writers have suggested that we don't take this film literally. Some of the ways that Tar is an exaggerated figure within the conducting world, she's a woman in that world. So few women conductors. What is the path that a female conductor would take to just be stoic, or someone like Lydia, who actually channels an enormous amount of passion and feeling to an extreme, and even almost, as some have noted, kind of comical, but for me, it's melodramatic. It's an exaggeration of something that is happening in her that she cannot channel outside of that world.
This is Denise Morris and Jan Hawken talking today about the film Tar. There are several scenes that are quite riveting because they so much conform to actual classroom scenes or seminar scenes that many of us who've taught could relate to, identifying with some of the criticisms students have of teachers and how you handle them. Do you want to talk about that Juilliard sequence?
It's a really amazing scene, and it resonates for people wide and far. It's a really interesting and important scene. It happens early in the film. And as you say, it's a learning environment with a person who is toxic, dealing with a young student, Max, who does an amazing job. The scene between the two of them, they were so good together. But what they draw out is the tensions around whether or not you're teaching students or you're trying to make your own point.
Yeah, this Juilliard sequence unfolds around her leading as a very prestigious conductor who is clearly intimidating to students, but she is meeting with student conductors, and one of the students who identifies as BIPOC and queer challenges her love of Bach. There is humility in Bach. He's not pretending he's certain about anything. It's always a question that involves the listener. It's never the answer. She argues that Bach has a lot to teach us as a musician about how to listen to music. And he's not buying it. He says Bach is one of these old white misogynist patriarchs, and his music does nothing for me, and I only want to listen to music that speaks to me as a BIPOC queer person. And so she's taking him on around that, and he says you can't separate the person from the music, and what his life was about kind of cancels him out for this student, Max. And she tries to get the student to listen again and to separate the man and the music. And early on, I could identify with this, kind of pushing the student in good ways to challenge his assumptions. And how much do you rule out by those criteria? How much do you even know about these musicians? And when you can't listen to so much, what do you sacrifice as a composer? And then he pushes back against that, playing with him on the piano and trying to reach him on a different level. But then she gets very cruel, and she can't pull back.
She gets thwarted, and she digresses to find herself divulging her own demons when she says, you have to sublimate yourself. You have to stand before the public and God and obliterate yourself. She have to end who you are to be in this world.
Yeah, she refuses to be identified as a feminist or even a woman composer. And then in other scenes, she's defending women and knows a lot about women composers who have not been recognized historically. But I think that lack of empathy toward this student in that scene made it unfold in a way that felt to me grippingly real in terms of what can happen in a student-teacher relationship in the classroom when a student keeps challenging. And actually, it was the opposite. Her ego was totally involved in that scene, trying to force this resistive student to accept her point of view.
It's the kind of conversation that we're probably having everywhere and maybe don't have an answer for, but is how do we account for our loves of art made by people who are not perfect?
Who are actively exploitive and oppressive, yeah.
Right. Tar, in that same scene, says now is the time to do work, conduct work that requires something of you. And I think that that is really compelling. What does it mean to take on something and to do something that requires something of you?
Yeah.
What are the times that we're in that provokes that kind of thinking on the part of someone who's successful, talented, and deeply flawed?
Yeah. I think we also come to read that scene against a late scene in the movie that is the basis for some criticism that it lampoons cancel culture. And we see later on students going after her and protesting against her at a book launch. We know, of course, they're right, that she has a history of sexual predation. But the case the students have put together, they stitched together in a way that completely misrepresents what went on in that classroom. And
right.
They've created a video that isn't true to what we've come to see as what happened. So it does kind of poke at the Me Too movement and going after people without knowing how to make a case based on a careful knowledge of what the grievance is. And so I think when you have a scene like that, as the film does, you do understandably open it up to criticism that it is very dismissive of the reaction to her. The way that scene is cut together in a video, we understand it as really overly maligning her and misrepresenting what happened.
I mean, I don't disagree, but I think the way that technology is used in the film is, it's intentional, of course. I mean, Lydia thinks that she can just erase her emails about Krista and that they will just disappear into the ether.
She has her own way of trying to control and falsify the past.
Right, yes, that's true. But she doesn't seem to understand the power of technology. It's almost like she's been so immersed in this other world. I mean, she's not that old, you know. It's like, come on, I'm older than she is. But, you know, technology can be used for the greater good and the greater harm. The idea that there's surveillance around our actions and our movements is very contemporary. And so the reason why these guys from the 19th century or whatever century didn't get their comeuppance is because they didn't go viral.
Before we end, I have to ask you about the place of motherhood and her role as a mother in this film, because often the mothering enters a story of a female protagonist either to condemn or to redeem her. And as her wife, Sharon, confronts her in a late scene, she charges that their daughter, they have a daughter together, she's the only person with whom your relationships are not transactional. She has a daughter with this woman, and in a way it does redeem her. as a powerful woman who loves this child and is, by many measures, a good parent and protective and attached to this little girl. What's your take on the role of mothering in her character and in the story?
I think it's really interesting because it could be very problematic to consider her one non-transactional relationship to be with her child. But it does allow for us to see a certain kind of humanity in Lydia. But at the same time, we see her as a fierce protector of her child.
When she protects her daughter from a bullying at school,
she
describes herself as the father, as the protector in the outer world.
Lydia is a bully. So how
herself,
some might say, how rich, you know, the bully protecting her child from the bully.
Is the one being that's worthy of her protection, yeah.
Right. But I also had some questions about how she exists in that world. You know, Lydia, she has a separate apartment, and she's not going to give it up because it's her place. I mean, on the one hand, if she weren't philandering bully, it would be like, oh, okay, so what? You've got your work apartment. But she has this other home where she has a wife and a child, and I wonder how that functions for Lydia. Many of us believe our homes and our relationships and our children provide us this kind of safe harbor from the ills of capitalist society.
Uh-huh.
But for Lydia, it seems like what happens inside that home is still work, and she doesn't seem to enjoy her time there or have the ability to really fulfill an intimate relationship with someone. And thus her partner, Sharon, says, your only non-transactional relationship is with your daughter.
Well, and I think we also see how that apartment provides her not only a room of her own, but a place where she can bring women in and do things that don't work in her domestic sphere with her family life.
Yeah. We know that Lydia's true love is her work.
Well, I think in conclusion, it's an interesting film worth seeing and discussing. And so much of the reaction to it registers many of the ambivalent feelings we hold toward powerful, ruthless women who we've come to love either as mentors in our own path of development. I mean, there are a lot of women who clearly have crushes on her and admire her, and as a mentor, the love of the work and the love of this person who leaves people under her very vulnerable to exploitation was a very interesting theme, and I think was handled in an unsettlingly subtle way.
I think we need more cinema that takes on these complicated, contradictory characters and subjects.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jan.
This is Jan Hawken and Denise Morris talking today about the film Tar, now available streaming.